Hey, this is Cedric. Today's episode with Mark Moss is brought to you by Ledin.io, a better home for your Bitcoin. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. With industry-best interest rates on savings, use your Bitcoin as collateral for loans, or double your Bitcoin stack with their Buy 2X program. Not yet a Ledin client? Start earning 9% on your USDC and 6.1% on your first two Bitcoin. Already a Ledin client? From now on, when a new Ledin client signs up using your referral link and funds their Bitcoin or USDC savings account, they can receive 10 USDC as a reward deposited straight into their account. Certain terms and conditions apply. The signer must create an account with your referral link, deposit at least 75 USDC or 0.0015 Bitcoin into their Ledin account for 15 days. Pretty simple, easy to get going. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast still get an exclusive offer of 50 free USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. We only have a few more weeks with Ledin as our lead sponsor, so I hope you guys are taking advantage of these fantastic offers and checking out all the dope Bitcoin financial services that they have to offer. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. In this conversation with Mark Moss, we discuss how three revolution cycles are happening now, how the last time these three cycles converged, the whole world changed, and how you can prepare for it. I hope you guys enjoy this one as much as I did. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Mark Moss.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Mark Moss is an entrepreneur, investor, student of history, sound money advocate, freedom maximalist, founder of Market Disruptors, the host of The Mark Moss Show on YouTube, and the host of the first nationally syndicated show about Bitcoin on iHeartRadio, also named The Mark Moss Show. Mark Moss, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm doing really well. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, man. I'm really excited to chat. I've been following you for a while, but I got to also see your presentation live in Dallas at BitBlock Boom. And I was really floored by it. It's one, a lot of great presentations there. They were all outstanding, but it's really probably the one that really sticks to me the most, that I think about the most, I remember the most, and I've revisited the most. So I'd really love to dig into that, you know, during our conversation here. But first, I'd love to get a little bit of context about, you know, who you are and maybe what your background is, maybe a little bit before sort of the shows and even Bitcoin. Were you always into economics and these sort of themes? Did you know what kind? Were you always an entrepreneur?
Yeah, sure. So, I got started with my investing career pretty young. As a matter of fact, I was just 18 years old, and one of my friends, his grandfather was helping him buy like these bank-owned repossessed homes. At the time in California, they were sitting on a ton of these homes, the banks were, and they just couldn't give them away fast enough. And so they were literally giving them away if you would just take them over and fix them up. And so I was 18, I bought a house, a duplex. I got it zeroed down. I didn't even have the money for the closing costs. I was so young. So I took a partner on, we got some credit cards, things like that. Did most of the work ourselves. I think I made like 30 grand on that first deal, and I was just hooked. And then, so I just started just buying, selling homes, flipping homes like crazy. And so, you know, then became my investing career. Over the years, I started a couple businesses. In the late 90s. I started trading these crazy things called these internet stocks. Nobody really knew what it was at the time. I remember my roommate quit his job and we were home day trading these things, trading these internet stocks, kind of like these cryptos things today. And then the crash came 2001. I thought it'd be a great idea to start an e-commerce business right at the bottom of the crash. And it wasn't easy to start an e-commerce business back then. There was no Shopify, no nothing like that. And I built this website. I think it was 20 grand, 25 grand. I had to build, pay this guy to build it. I went to these brands and I said, hey, I built this website. I want to sell your products on my website. And they laughed at me and they told me no one will ever buy anything online. That's ridiculous. And I said, well, I think they will. And I spent all this money to build the site and a lot of brands turned me down. They didn't even want their stuff sold on the internet. It was kind of weird. And then I continued building businesses. I had two different businesses that I was kind of building. Plus my real estate business was going. I ended up doing having a Fortune 500 exit on that, on the tech company. I sold my other company and basically just put everything into real estate, developing. I moved on from the small fix and flips. Now I was developing real estate, big projects. Multi-million-dollar projects, eight-figure projects, and projects that were taking, 3-5 years at a time. And then the 2008 crash came, and that was bad news. I was completely invested into Southern California real estate, and it didn't work out too well for me. We'll just say that. And so, you'd kind of ask the question, was I always interested in like investing in finance and things like that? And the answer is not really. I mean, I had spent about a decade investing. The lines between being an investor and a business owner are very blurred. I fixed and flipped well over 100 homes. Was I a real estate investor or was that my business? You know what I mean? So lines are pretty blurred. So I was a business, entrepreneur, I was an investor, whatever. But when I got wiped out, I was like, what the heck? Like, what just happened? Like, I'm pretty good at making money, but what the heck is this whole financial casino thing going on out here that I don't even know anything about? And I realized there was a gap in my education that unfortunately cost me everything. I mean, I was literally, I was at the top of the world. I was 30 years old. I was married, had my first kid, like retired, like custom house. Like it was it, I was done. And next thing you know, I'm like millions of dollars in debt. And so, I grew up racing dirt bikes. And so I just broken all the bones of my body. I have metal in all of my limbs, and I'm kind of used to just wiping out and just kind of going, let me just dust off this, my shoulders, and just jump back on the bike and go again. And so I did. But this time I thought, you know what, there was a piece in my education missing. I got to figure what this is. So I started learning about the financial system, kind of became a gold bug. I learned a concept that changed everything for me. It's something I still talk about all the time today. And the concept is that money is like energy. It doesn't disappear. It transfers. When I lost my wealth, it didn't disappear. Mm-hmm. It transferred to somebody else. And that didn't sit well with me. I'm not the most competitive guy in the world, but the fact that somebody else got my money when I lost it didn't sit well with me. And so basically at that point, I kind of vowed to never let that happen again. And so for the last 12 years, I've been studying the financial markets, studying this kind of phenomenon known as wealth transfers. I've been talking about it ever since. And I think we're going into the largest wealth transfer we'll ever see. I'm studying it so I can be on the receiving end of wealth transfers and not on the giving end of wealth transfers. Needless to say, after kind of building my wealth back up, I became a gold bug, became totally disillusioned with the entire system, realized how much of a sham the whole financial system is, the fiat money system, et cetera. And I kind of just got over politics and I was just over the whole thing by like 2012. I was just over it. Bitcoin was kind of catching my eye because I was, a tech entrepreneur, I was kind of in that space. But, it was rising, falling. I wasn't really paying attention to it. I was in 2015, I was in the process of setting up my multi-flag lifestyle. And so I was working with a group of attorneys in Panama and setting up a trust and bank account so I could work on a residency and a visa, passports, et cetera. And I took another look at Bitcoin in 2015 and I said, dang, this is kind of the same thing. It's a way for me to get money out of the banking system, which is exactly what I was trying to do. And so 2015, I took the bite out of Bitcoin, went in. At the time, it was just a way to get money out of the banking system. But as I started to learn a little bit more, right, you got to put a little skin in the game first. Once you put a little skin in the game, you start paying attention to it. And I realized we finally have a tool that we can win. And so as disillusioned as I was with the entire system, the political system, the financial system, I realized we finally have a tool that we can win. At that point, I said, I got to tell everybody I know about this. And since 2015, I've been telling everybody I know about it, everybody I can reach. 2016, I was, started telling a lot of people. I kind of started a newsletter. People were following along and things like that. I went into the crypto rabbit hole. From 2016 to 2019, I wrote a cryptocurrency research newsletter. I personally published over 1,000 pages of research onto every crypto asset for that stretch. But you know what I've seen from a lot of people that have to be in this space for a long time, the more research you do, the longer you're in, the more you realize there's one option. And so in 2019, I had my partner buy me out of that business. I walked away from that, and I've just been focusing on Bitcoin ever since. And so I'm pumping out as much content as I possibly can and trying to change the world.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I really think that was a fantastic answer, and it kind of answered a lot of my questions, though.
Sorry.
No, that's great. That's fantastic in a lot of ways. And the two things that really stuck out to me then there, that was like, I'm kind of curious what maybe your mindset was at 18 about risk and, you know, maybe not going to college or university or what a lot of people consider maybe the traditional route. And then I'm kind of curious, when did your thinking start turning from just making money and being good at business to, you know, sort of more flag theory and things like Bitcoin and getting your money out of the banking system and maybe preparing or protecting yourself, things of that nature?
Yeah. So, you know, it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. As a father, I try to think about, like, what am I doing with my kids? What made me kind of reverse engineering, like me? What happened with me? Why did I turn out the way I did? I think a lot of it was just the way I was raised. I think that's, you know, the nature versus nurture type of argument. And so my dad was a contractor, which I guess is an entrepreneur, right? So I kind of grew up in like an entrepreneurial home, grew up in South Texas, grassroots conservative. My dad grew up on a farm. And anyone that knows anything about a farm is you work your ass off like crazy. And so my dad is like the hardest worker ever. And he's a construction guy. And since the time I was 9 years old, he hauled my ass off to work and made me work. And I hated it. I would cry the whole way. He didn't care. But, you know, looking back on it, I think that was a super big piece, you know, that kind of made me a hard worker. I think it also doing construction as a kid, especially in South Texas, getting dirty, getting hot and sweaty. I swore to myself, I would never do a job I had to get dirty like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe that kind of helped me out there. And then, so I think, you know, kind of being growing up in like that entrepreneurial home, being forced to be a hard worker, even though I didn't want to be. And then also, like I said, grassroots conservative. So like politics is discussed around my kitchen table, right? Like my parents, my family gatherings, it's just like we talk politics. And so I kind of grew up in that. I think as far as going to college, I think I wanted to go to college and party like a bunch of my friends were. My parents didn't really give me that option. They wanted me to go to community college, and I didn't want to do it. I was just over it. And so I just decided I would start working full time, and I did. And, you know, as far as how I got that first real estate deal, you know, it's hard for me to really think back. I think, you know, your network is your net worth. If I look back, pretty much every deal I've ever been in my whole life was from somebody that I knew. So I don't think it was something where I was like, oh, I have this great idea, I'll go start buying and selling homes. It was more like, luckily, my best friend at the time, his grandfather owned a bank, and his grandfather kind of had him doing it. And I just watched. I was like, well, I want to do that. I didn't partner with him. I had to do it on my own. But the fact that I had him doing it, I think, was enough. So, you know, I guess, you know, my childhood kind of set me up for that. As a kid, you know, things were different when we were kids. You know, I'm sure you would imagine, or you would agree. You know, we didn't have the excess that we have today. You know what I mean? Like growing up, even in a well-off, you know, in a middle-class home, you'd have one pair of shoes. Like that was just it. Like things were a lot simpler back then. And I, as a kid, I mean, I had like a lawn mowing route and I mowed lawns and I saved up money. And so I think that kind of geared me more for that entrepreneurial life. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question.
Yeah. When did you start thinking about more, preparing for getting your money out of the system, or thinking about, you know, more than just building a business and if it got wiped out by cycles in economics, but like, how can you protect yourself more long-term and sort of how maybe those cycles can stop impacting you as much?
Well, unfortunately, there's a saying that I like to say over and over, and it says that some lessons cannot be taught. They can only be learned. And so, unfortunately, that lesson wasn't taught to me, or I didn't learn it. I didn't know anything about it. As I said, I was really good at making money. I mean, I made millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars, but I didn't know anything about what to do with that money after I made it. And so, like I said, there was this whole piece of missing in my financial education. I knew, now I try to teach people there's three ways you need to focus on money, three ways. And most people don't really understand this. It's a pretty basic concept, but the first way you have to focus on money is you have to focus on wealth creation. You got to make money. Then once you've made money, then you focus on wealth accumulation. So you're getting your wealth to make more wealth. And then third and finally, you need to focus on wealth preservation. You got to protect the money. Most people that haven't made money think this is a ridiculous statement, but it's harder to keep your money than it is to make it. And so you got to focus on those three things. Mm. And so I was really good at the wealth creation part, but I didn't know anything about the wealth accumulation nor the wealth preservation part. Right. And so necessity is the mother of invention or whatever. So after getting my ass kicked, after losing all my money, that's what forced me to go in and try to figure out, pop the hood, like what's going on under here. There's something I don't understand. I need to figure it out. Now, at that time, I had a lot of friends who still to this day, it's a dozen years later, still have never recovered. I mean, it's devastating to go, to go through that. But again, I think my action sports upbringing has taught me just to kind of get back on the horse after I break a bone. And so I just popped the hood, like, what the heck's going on in here? Let me figure it out. And let me come back and do it again better this time. And so that's what I've been doing.
Yeah. It seems like in a lot of ways, you've been preparing your whole life for the moment that's happening externally, in terms of the macro world and the forces that are happening. And I'd love for you to kind of, outline, a little bit about this thesis or hypothesis or vision or however you want to call it about what's going on and how, three cycles are converging on the world right now and how this actually has happened before.
Yeah.
And to kind of maybe give some backdrop to that, there's a lot of protests right now in the world and there's a lot of debt. And how does that sort of, what do you see there, like in terms of these cycles and maybe giving some context to, before we get into maybe some of the specifics of the cycles?
Yeah. So I think, going back to school, obviously I didn't want to continue on to higher education. So I wasn't super interested in a lot of subjects, but the one subject I always liked was history. I always liked history. And so I still love history. And so, if you watch any of my videos on YouTube or whatever, you'll see, I'm always trying to pull in like this historical narrative into it to kind of help explain that, to give perspective. I think history is great for getting perspective and for learning lessons of the past. So I don't have to learn them the hard way, like I've done in before. And so I've always loved that history. And maybe when I had to go kind of figure things out in 2008 and figure out what this financial system was, it sent me back into history. Like, how was the financial system started? What is the central bank? Why do we have this kind of a money system? And so you kind of had to go back into history. And so I've always dug into that. And I think, I just think it's fascinating. Like I said, so maybe that's just me or whatever. But what I've noticed is that as much as like the world changes, as much as people think, like we have progress and like we have, cars, and we didn't have cars 100 years ago. So like the world is changing, but most people think it changes like linear. But really we see like progress is like really like exponential. It like grows really fast. But as much as we have this exponential progress, at the same time, we have these cycles that continue to repeat within that progress. And, I think that's super fascinating. When you're studying financial markets, you're looking for indicators. You're looking for hopefully leading indicators that will tell you, what would happen in the future. And what's important when you're looking at financial indicators is not to look at just one. You're trying to look at a bunch of indicators that will hopefully give you this kind of a picture, this conclusive picture. And so what I started doing is I started looking across different areas and started looking for different cycles across different areas and see where they were repeating and how they were what they were doing. And then I noticed that there's like three different areas that work on three different timeframes of cycles, but they all actually work together and they're all converging right now at the exact time, which doesn't happen very often. And so when it does, it's pretty powerful. And I think that's exactly what we're going through right now.
Yeah. It's what I think is fascinating is that the way you link these three different revolutionary cycles. Most people kind of just isolate them and maybe think about one at a time. Maybe you think about a technological cycle and you think about how to maybe capitalize that on that. Or maybe you think about the financial cycle and you're focused on maybe Bitcoin. It's really fascinating when you start to link them and overlay them. So in terms of timeframes, though, these cycles, most of them are almost like way more than, one lifespan, whether it's or about a lifespan. And so I'd kind of like to talk about, the political and social and cultural cycles and the revolutions going on now that are 80 and 250 year cycles, and maybe outline a little bit of like what we see. Maybe start coming, from further back. So maybe a couple 80 year cycles ago, what did we see and kind of where that's leading to?
Yeah. So you made a good point that some of these cycles are beyond a lifetime. And so that's one of the reasons why we have to go back and study history, because some of these cycles repeat longer than a lifetime. And so you wouldn't know about them unless you go back and study history. The other thing that's important about to know about history is that, you know, especially today in today's cancel culture, it's very scary because they're literally trying to get rid of history. And the thing is with history is that we have to know the history. Now, whether the history is good or bad, it doesn't really matter. We need to know that so we can change and improve, et cetera. So if history was really, really bad, well, shoot, let's do it different in the future. If history was really, really good, well, let's go back to that, things like that. And so you kind of have to have that. I think that was one of the big things that happened. The French Revolution and the American Revolution happened at about the same time. But they ended up very different. And I think the reason why they ended up very different is because the French Revolution threw everything away, burned everything down, no history, and they tried to start from scratch with no foundation to work off of. Whereas the American Revolution started with a working system that they kind of pruned and got rid of the pieces they didn't like, and the pieces that worked, they added more of. And I think that's one of the big differences with those two revolutions. The Americans kept the history, whereas the French got rid of it. And so I think that's an important lesson to learn going through history. When you see these cancel culture people trying to get rid of history, it's like, no, look, you could say it's bad, but we can't lose it. As a side note, if we go back to like the Roman Republic, which was one of the best governments in history, you know, 500 years of a great government, eventually the Roman Republic turned into the Roman Empire, which of course changed the political system there. When the Roman Republic went downhill 250 years, they got taken over by the barbarians. The barbarians came in and just wiped it out, including all of the history, all of the books, the library, et cetera. And that's what sent the world into the Dark Ages. Like, you have to have that history. Otherwise you're starting from scratch. Eventually, you know, we got out of the Dark Ages, went to the Renaissance Age, and we got the printing press, and we started to be able to get information out to people again. And we got that explosion. But that's an important piece. So that was a long segue. You were asking, I guess, about the political, social, cultural cycles.
Yeah. So we kind of covered a little bit of the 250 year cycles there with the American French Revolution, which is like 250 years, you know, ago. And maybe before that is the Protestant Reformation. And maybe before we get to sort of maybe the 80 year populist sort of cycles.
Yeah.
What were those sort of like, and we touched on the American and French a little bit, but like, what were they really rejecting those?
Well, what's interesting with these cycles is you have like, they have these cycles. They just show up everywhere, and they show up like on all these different, they show up on these different time frames, and then they kind of repeat and they compound, they get bigger, bigger, bigger. So even I'm not into technical analysis, but even if you get into technical analysis, you'll see like Elliott wave theory and things like that, where they have these kind of numerical cycles and then crashes. You mentioned the 84 year cycle. So in the political, social, cultural, there's like a 28 year cycle, there's an 84 year cycle, and there's the 250 year cycle. So every 84 years, like there's like a populist uprising, or what's called like a regime change cycle. And so 84 years ago was the end of World War II. We had Hitler, Mussolini, and in the US, we had the New Deal, which kind of turned the US into kind of like a socialist nation. So every 84 years, 84 years before that, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, which led to the European Spring, which is the largest revolution in history. And what's interesting, again, with the numbers is 3 times 84 equals 252. And so then you have the third 84 year cycle is the 250 year cycle. And that's where you have massive revolution. And so, as you just said, right? So 250 years ago was the American French Revolution. 250 years before that was the Protestant Reformation. And I think what that's rejecting is centralization or globalization. I think it's obviously apparent in the American Revolution and the French Revolution, rejecting the king, rejecting the monarchy. And in the United States, they set up a decentralized government, right? The United States is a republic. A lot of people still think it's a democracy. Maybe it kind of is today, but it was founded as a republic. So all the states were supposed to be independent and sovereign. And so while they rejected the centralization of the monarchy, they set up a decentralized form of government, which was actually kind of modeled after what Rome had. 250 years before that was the Protestant Reformation, but it was also the same thing. At the time, right, the church and the state were kind of put together. the people didn't really have access to the Bible. So the church kind of held the information. Mm-hmm. They said the only way to get, you know, get to God is to come through the central authority of the church. But the printing press had kind of decentralized that information, and people found out, hey, we don't need you anymore. We can have our own decentralized path. And so I think when you look at those, that's what it tells to me, or it kind of shows me. And so I think today, 250 years, you know, later after the American Revolution, I think we're seeing the same thing, right? And so we can see that, I think anyone who's paying attention, I think, can see that we're pretty close and hopefully dang close to peak centralization or peak globalization. And so we have the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization and the World Trade Organization and the World Meteorological Association, and we have the IMF and we have the UN, and I mean, you name it, right? And they've basically all usurped the government's authority, right? And not to get too deep into politics, but I mean, if you go back into Donald Trump's presidency, when he went to Davos at the World Economic Forum and he said, he gave a speech and it was kind of the end of his career. And he said, look, the U.S. is sovereign. The U.S. will not lay down its sovereignty to the World Economic Forum. We will work with the world, but we're sovereign. And that was kind of what put the target on his back, I believe, one of the things, without getting too deep into that. Mm-hmm. But the point is that these NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have kind of usurped the nation states. And so we're at this peak centralization. It's easy to see the World Health Organization tells countries to lock down and everyone locks down, right? And so you can kind of see that. Obviously the IMF, we can see them calling the shots on the, you know, money. Even now today, news came out with, you know, El Salvador. IMF says they're going to give them a loan now, blah, blah, blah. And so I think you can see that we're at this peak centralization. And at the same time, we can see that people are pushing back against that at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's like Newton's third law, like each action has an equal and opposite reaction. So the more the government tries to squeeze, the more people push back against it. Before the pandemic broke out, so this has been going on for a long time, I think you can really see that it started. I think Donald Trump getting elected was a sign of that. I think Brexit over in Europe was a sign of that. I think Greece is a sign. And I think we've been seeing signs for, you know, 3-4 years. It's really escalating. Pre-pandemic, we saw 10 countries with over 1 million people each in the streets marching. Right. And as soon as the pandemic broke out, everybody went home and it was quiet. Pretty conveniently. But today it's back. And of course, if you're on mainstream media, you're not seeing it, but if you're on social media, you probably are. And there's millions of people marching all over the world, pushing back against the centralization. And, you know, as bad as things look, as scary as that is, I think history tells us that there's this natural human drive for freedom. Centralization always fails. And I believe that it fails. I believe the pendulum, we can have like this pendulum that swings to centralization or globalization, and then it swings back to decentralization. I keep saying that the pendulum is maxing out and it's just about to start swinging back the other way.
Yeah. It's very interesting there. And what I think about so much is like, how does the individual, you know, withstand these forces or navigate through these forces and sort of protect themselves, or maybe just get out of the way of these things. And I think that's kind of getting harder in today's environment. One of the other cycles that, you know, you touch on is the we me 80-year cycle. Right. What is that one kind of about?
Yeah, that's a cool one. So, you know, really, again, like not trying to get into politics. So I try to stay away from all the labels, all that crap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think especially today more than ever with this double speak that, you know, from 1984, a lot of the words have lost their meanings. And so people want to argue over socialism and fascism and communism. And is fascism is right wing and socialism is left wing. And what's capitalism anymore? Capitalism is slavery. And like, we've lost meaning of all these words. And so I think if we just kind of get rid of all those labels and really just kind of break it down kind of on two different sides of the spectrum, we have individualism, and the opposite side, we have collectivism. And so I think that fascism, which people say is on the right, and communism on the left, whatever, I think they're both collectivism. And on the other side is individualism. And so the we me cycle is basically that, right? So the we is collectivism, centralization, and the me is individualism or decentralization. And so it's kind of like there's this pendulum that just basically swings back and forth, and that works on an 80-year time frame. So that's kind of on this populist uprising cycle. So typically on an 80-year time frame, you'll see that. And there was actually a really cool book written about this called The Pendulum. That's the name of the book. And they document this back for thousands of years. And they give really good case studies of how that works. And basically, it's kind of like, it's almost like everything. I mean, just look at the stock market chart, right? And you have like the mean, and then the charts move up and down. And the farther that it stretches to one side, the more that it corrects to the other. That's kind of exactly what's happening with this pendulum. And I would say that it's reactive. And so what happens is things get so centralized, so oppressive, so bad that when it swings back way harder to the other way, but it overreacts and it goes too far the other way. And then it corrects back. It's kind of like if you're bowling with your kids and you put like the bumpers up and then the ball is just kind of ping ponging back and forth in there. So that's the we me cycle, the individualism and the collectivism. And it fits right in that 80-year, kind of 84-year timeframe populist uprising cycle, which is also kind of this generational theory cycle as well. Like it's been kind of popularized from the fourth turning, also fits kind of within that as well.
Yeah, that one's really fascinating as well. I do want to turn to the technological cycles, which you've kind of noted around 50 years. You know, my son, he's turning 9. He always asks me, when is there going to be some new technology pop? And I'm like, oh, come on, stuff comes out every day. You know, you just got to switch or something. And he's like, no, something different, something new, something that flies or, you know, and it's kind of hard to explain to him, you know, that like, well, you know, there's been a lot of stagnation and I don't know what's coming next, but maybe you can outline a little bit of like what some of these cycles have meant for humanity. And sort of like how often they happen.
Yeah. So what's interesting is, so we're talking about three cycles. We just talked about the first one, the political, social, cultural. Now we're going to a technological revolution. And then third, we can talk about a financial revolution. But what's interesting is that they all three work together. And so what do I mean by that? So cycles are reactionary, right? So things get too oppressive. So we react and we move the other way to, you know, decentralization. And typically solutions are supposed to come to problems. So if I have a problem, I go find a solution. I say supposed to, because today with central bank printing trillions of dollars, we have a bunch of money chasing solutions that we don't need. But typically solutions come to problems. And so what's interesting is that politically, socially, or culturally, there's a problem. And then technologically, we'll come up with a solution for that. And then a technological revolution drives the next financial revolution. So the political, social, cultural need creates the technological revolution that then drives the financial cycle. So it's reactive all the way through. And so let me give you an example of what I mean when I talk about a technological revolution. So to your son's case, a technological revolution is not a new technology. A new technology would be the iPhone. That's a new technology. Uber, Airbnb, that was a new technology. Those are not technological revolutions. A technological revolution is something so big, so revolutionary, that it literally changes the course of humanity. The iPhone didn't change the course of humanity, right? We already had a telephone. There was already other smartphones out, whatever. It was cool and it made our life nice, but those technologies, they extend cycles. So Uber and Airbnb extended the previous technological cycle. It didn't create brand new financial cycles. So let me give you what I'm talking about. So there's been five. So we go back to the 1700s. We had the Industrial Revolution. So people worked in farms and the cottage industry, and now they could work in cities and factories. And that changed the course of humanity. About 50 years later, we had the age of steam engines and steel. And so for all of humanity, we had horsepower and manpower. And now we had steam engines. It was massive. And then we had steel. We could now build skyscrapers. We could build bridges, right? Approximately 50 years later, we had electricity. I like to joke and say at the time, electricity was just a digital candle. What do we need that digital candle for? Fires worked great for light for 5,000 years, right? What do we need that for? Of course, but it changed humanity, right? It changed everything. It allows us to even do what we're doing today. Mm-hmm. About 50 years later, we had the age of oil, automobiles, and mass production. And again, changed humanity. For all of humanity, people walked and rode horses. And now we could drive. Now we could transport things. Now we could drive things. So that was massive. Oil showed us, you know, harnessing energy, unlocking cheap energy, which allowed the world to flourish. About 50 years later, 1971, we had the age of the microprocessor, which allowed us to have personal computers, allowed us to have telecommunications, and of course, the internet and Zoom, what we're doing right now. And 1971 plus 50 years puts us right here at 2021. And I believe we are on another technological revolution. Not a new technology, a revolution. And so just like the digital candle at the time, What do we need that for? Candles have worked great for 5,000 years. Why do we need a digital candle? At the time, that's all it was. But in the future, it became so much more. And every time there's a new technology, people say that. What do we need a car for? It's noisy. It's stinky. It's dangerous. Like horses work fine, right? When the internet came out, it's a way to send an electronic message. Maybe one day we'll have be able to buy stuff online. I don't know. But of course, today our car's hooked to something called a cloud, using something called social media to like navigate us around traffic. And so anyway, we're on the verge of this technological revolution. Now, that's of course decentralized technology, right? That's Bitcoin. It's decentralized technology. And what's interesting about that is just as the world is reaching peak centralization, and the world is rejecting that, pushing back on peak centralization to move to decentralization, we have a technological breakthrough, technological revolution that gives the world exactly what they need.
I hope you guys are enjoying this rip with Mark as much as I am. But before we get back into it, I want to share with you some information about Bitcoin 2022. For those of you who were there last year, I don't have to tell you guys how much fun it was. And honestly, if you don't have your tickets yet, I don't know what you guys are waiting for. For 2022, the conference has been expanded and will include a fourth day for Sound Money Fest Music Festival. And organizers are expecting more than 30,000 Bitcoiners. The Bitcoin 2022 conference, which celebrates Bitcoin over 4 days, April 6th through 9th, 2022, with four different passes. The 4 days include Industry Day, 2 days of main events and speakers, and lastly, a Festival Day, which is a day of music and networking. Prices will continue to rise over the next few months, so get in early and use our code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off your tickets. Bitcoin 2021 was lit. It was huge and a massively good time. Getting to meet guests on the show, joking around with Bitcoin Twitter friends, and chilling out on South Beach is going to be off the hook. Remember to use the code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off your tickets. And now let's get back into the Bitcoin Matrix with Mark Moss as we get into financial cycles, tech revolutions, Bitcoin, Satoshi, and massive wealth transfers.
It's kind of interesting there in terms of, I'm not sure if Bitcoin is the revolution or if there's more to it than that in your framework. And if Bitcoin is the revolution, is sort of the revolution attributed to one person, like Satoshi, or sort of these other revolutions, I don't think of them as being attributed to one person. And I just kind of want to see your take on that and sort of, or maybe you think that there were other notable individuals in these other revolutions that should be called out and sort of are the shoulders of the giants that we're standing on.
I wouldn't tie a single name to any of those. I mean, obviously, you know, we could go back to electricity, for example, and some say it was Tesla, some say it was, you know, Edison. I don't think that's really important. It's the technology itself. That's important. So, you know, was it Satoshi? Was it Hal Finney? Was it, you know, Adam Back? Was it, Szabo? Was it Satoshi? Was it all of them? I don't think it really matters. But the technology is here and right. We're using it. Right. So I think that's important to understand. Going back to kind of, I told you for the last 12 years, I've been studying these wealth cycles, or I'm sorry, these wealth transfers. Right. Mm. And so, wealth transfers happen in certain environments. So some ways they happen would be through times of volatility, like a big market crash, for example. Mm-hmm. They transfer wealth to people. But one of the biggest ways these wealth transfers happen is through technological revolutions. So if you go back through each of these technological revolutions, you can see in the age of the microprocessor, the personal computer, the internet, you have names like, Bill Gates, or you have, Steve Jobs, right? But if you go back to automobiles, there was no Gates or Jobs. It was Ford, right? It was Chrysler. If you go back to railroads, you have Carnegie, you have Rockefeller Oil. And so it was different names every time. So when you have this new technological revolution, it opens up a new opportunity where the old guard doesn't usually get in, and it creates new opportunities for new people that get into these new technologies at that new time. Right. The other thing I think that's important to understand is, like I said, they drive the markets. So for example, the last 50 years in the world, what's driven the financial markets? The FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, right? Before that, what was it? It was the automobile stocks, GE or General Motors, right, or whatever. So Ford, obviously, right? We kind of go back before it was the utility companies, the railroad companies. And so they drive the financial cycles. And so I think that's another important piece. Another important piece, I think, and I think this one's pretty important, especially in terms of Bitcoin. You kind of asked about Bitcoin specifically, if it's the revolution. And I would say that, again, if problems come to solutions, I'm sorry, if solutions come to problems, then what are the problems that we have politically, socially, and culturally? Well, there's a lot of problems. I like to say that if we had an oak tree and there was like 10,000 leaves on it, and every one of those leaves was a problem that we had, from, you know, obesity and the divorce rate to the income inequality to supply chains backing up today. I mean, you name whatever problem you want. At the base of that tree, at the root, sits the money printer. That's the base of every single problem that we have today. So then basically what I'm saying is this unlimited money supply is a big, big problem. And anybody having the power and control over that money supply to be able to create more of it is a big, big problem. So that's one. And ultimately, that's really the only problem, but I'll kind of break it down into two more, which kind of spill into that same one. The other problem that we have that's a big problem, I think, that pretty much, you're a content creator, you would agree, is censorship. But when I say censorship, I'm not just talking about censorship as in, like, if you say the wrong thing, YouTube deletes your channel. I'm talking about, that's a problem, obviously, but even censorship in the sense where my wealth is censored, meaning one, the central bank can just print more of it and steal my wealth. Two, if I want to send it to you, they can stop that, block it, prevent it. PayPal teamed up with the Anti-Defamation League, and now the ADL put out a list of all the people they think shouldn't be allowed to get payments anymore. And now PayPal blocks all those payments. They share it with other people. And so we're being censored in our wealth. It's being stolen from us. It's being manipulated. So that's a big problem. And then a third problem, and this one is a really big problem, which again goes back to the money printer, but this is a big problem, especially just in the last 12 months. And that is that we used to have a rule of law. The Constitution was a rule of law that was set in stone, and it's supposed to be simple enough that everybody understands it. So I know what the Constitution says, and I can plan my life based off of those laws. You can plan your life based off those laws. But today we don't have a rule of law anymore. Today we're ruled by men who change the rules arbitrarily whenever they feel like it. So I'm having a live event in Miami next month. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'd love to extend tickets to you and anybody else listening. I was thinking about having it next year because I kind of threw it together really quick and I didn't have the time. My team said, hey, let's push it to next year. It's the holidays, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if we'll be able to travel next year. Right. I don't know. My sister is an ER doctor in California. She knew that she was going to be forced out of her job. So she started working on setting up a private practice. She started meeting with attorneys, got her legal work, got her insurance, put a deposit on the place. And then the governor changed the law. And now every single person in the state has to comply. So she can't have a business there. And so society doesn't work like that. We have to have a rule of law that we can build on, like we can build our life, right? So if those are three big problems, then we need solutions to those. So instead of having an unlimited money supply, we need something with a fixed supply cap.
Yep.
Instead of having a system that men can manipulate, we need something that no one can control. Instead of having censorship, we need something that's censorship resistant. And instead of having something that has the ability to change the rules, we need something that has immutable law, not governance, immutable law. I think, in my opinion, those are the big problems. That's the revolution. And so if we can solve those problems, that's a revolution that changes the way the world works for humanity. I also think that if you understand, if you would agree that those four problems, if we could solve those, we could revolutionize the world. And then you look at the decentralized revolution, Bitcoin, and you look at the other, 10,000 or 12,000 altcoins, I would just ask, out of those 12,000, which ones can solve those problems? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is just one.
Yeah, I think we both know that. How good are humans at imagining the future?
Yeah, that's a funny one, isn't it? Yeah, you know, humans are horrible at imagining the future. We've never been able to do that. I did a tweet thread probably a year or two ago, and it was like every new technology that came out, and it was like the people who said it would never work, kind of like the people told me that no one would ever buy anything online. They literally laughed at me. I mean, that literally happened to me. And so the reason why humans are no good at imagining the future is because all we can do is imagine a better version of what we have today. We have cars, well, flying cars, sure. But we can't imagine something new because we don't have the building blocks to build those things. So when I, going back, I kind of threw that out kind of like with the internet before, or even like with the candle. Oh, it's kind of like a digital candle. Okay, cool. It doesn't burn out. I can use it forever. That's cool. But like, what do I really need that for? We didn't envision all the things that electricity would be doing because we just didn't know. Right. Kind of same with the internet, like at the time. And I remember back in 1995, 97, like it was a way to send electronic messages. And we had these online message boards, chat rooms. And I remember one day we thought we would be able to buy and sell stuff online. But you know, it didn't work back then. It was too slow, et cetera. But again, back to the car kind of example, we didn't know we'd have a cloud and our car would be hooked to something called a cloud using social media. So we're just not good at it, you know? And so even looking at this decentralized revolution and going, okay, these are the three big problems. If we solve that, what does that mean for the world? Like, probably the oldest problem that man has had since the beginning of time, probably the oldest problem in the world is that it's protecting my private property. You may come steal my chickens. So you and I band together and now those guys come take our chickens and our goats. So we make a village and then we make a kingdom and then we make a country, right? The country, the United States, is main role is to protect our private property rights. That's the oldest problem in the world. What happens to humanity when you take that problem away, when you solve that problem? I mean, I don't really know what that means, but I know it's massive. It's the biggest problem that we've ever had. And also, like, I think about it in terms of Charlie Munger says that show me the incentives, I show you the outcome. So the fiat system is, and really the money system for all of time has been a system of lies and theft and deceit and manipulation and changing the purity of the coins and the sizes of the coins. Obviously today they're pushing buttons and printing more trillions more dollars, et cetera. And so the incentive structure is for them to lie and deceive and steal. And so then there's a saying that says a fish stinks from the head down. Like in a business, culture is set by the leader of that company. And then the rest of the company kind of follows. So when we have our leaders who are basically out just stealing and all looking out for themselves, what happens with the rest of the country? If we can shift that, if we can change that incentive structure. So right now we see in the United States, and they spent $2.5 trillion in Afghanistan, no big deal. Armed the rebels, you know, they're in the top 15% of all armed militaries in the world now, no big deal. That was a big success, apparently. They spent all our money, blah, blah, blah. Nobody cared, and they're just going to go raise taxes and just steal more of our money now. So now they want to come after bank accounts that, you know, have more than $600 in them. They want to go after unearned income, you know, all these things. But what if the government couldn't just take your money? What if they couldn't just seize your bank account? What if they were, then the incentive structure changes? And what if the government then was actually forced to provide you a valuable good or service in exchange to earn your money? How much would that change the world?
Wow.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. So imagine the future is hard to say, but I know it's big. I know it's real big.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's interesting. Another cycle is like world reserve currencies. You know, the U.S. dollar has been the world's reserve currency for about 100 years, I would love for you to kind of like describe like measures of wealth and sort of how a society kind of like looks at wealth from that perspective or measures it.
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, especially in today's day and age, I mean, where the government's literally just printing trillions of dollars. And unfortunately, you know, most people think that they can just print more money, another couple trillion dollars, throw another trillion and just pass it out to everybody in the stimmy and like everyone's going to be wealthy, right? But the reality is that money isn't wealth, right? Money isn't wealth. Money measures wealth, or it measures how much wealth you could acquire. But really at the end of the day, wealth is goods and services. And so I use this one all the time, but if you and I were stuck on a deserted island and we had no boat, no phone, no food, no nothing, but we had a briefcase with $1 billion in it, would we be rich? Would we be wealthy? No, because we have nowhere to spend that money. That money is worthless. If there was a guy on the island that had a little shack with some coconuts, he would be more rich than we were. Right. And so the money itself isn't wealth. It's the goods and services. And so what's important to understand about that is that when you increase the money supply, but you don't increase the goods and services, there's no more wealth. You just cause the prices to go up because you have more money chasing the same goods and services. And then when you look at these financial revolution cycles, you'll see that they repeat kind of in these countries. You talked about the United States with 100 years, but there's also the wealth of a nation. So the wealth of a nation has been typically, what can it output? What can it produce? How much can it send offshore? So you typically look at like the schools, how good are the schools doing, which would then lead to people that can then solve problems, create solutions, create products, good services. Then they export those goods and services, which then brings revenue back in the country, which is how the United States took over as the world superpower from Britain. You know, we were the ones shipping all the supplies when they were going to war. And so then we would export services, we'd bring money back. And that would be the wealth of a nation. The United States would be a very, very wealthy nation. As a matter of fact, through World War One and Two, we were, because like I said, we supplied all those supplies.
The guy on the island.
We ended up, the United States ended up with 2/3 of the world's gold, 2/3, because we were a wealthy nation because we produced goods and services. Of course, anyone paying attention to the pandemic today knows that we don't produce any goods and services. The only good and service that we produce in offshore today is financial services.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I saw today, I think it was Senator Hawley proposed a bill. It probably won't go anywhere. I was just kind of skimming through it. I didn't read it in depth, but he proposed a bill that would say that all goods and services have to have at least 50% of their materials made in the United States. Mm. I was hoping that after the pandemic broke out last year and we found out the United States was naked, right? Swimming with no clothes on. Literally like 90% of our antibiotics come from China. All of our rare earth elements come from China. Our PE stuff, you know, the hospital gear comes from China. I was hoping that might be a big wake up call and like maybe we would start onshoring and bringing some of this stuff back. But it hasn't happened. That's led to massive problems in supply chains that we have right now. While I like the idea of Hawley trying to put a bill like this together, I think it still misses the point that it's still more central planning.
Right.
Like it's only just going to mess things up even more. But that's another subject.
Yeah. It's very interesting your take on that because, you know, it is central planning. It is bringing the goods and services and manufacturing, maybe other things back home. You know, that kind of brings up like how policy is just driving a lot of different aspects of our lives right now. Maybe you could touch a bit on, you know, I don't even know if it's just, I mean, I wonder, is the legacy financial system, you know, breaking apart? But I kind of want to go a little broader. Like, I mean, it just seems like policy is driving a lot of decisions right now, creating issues in supply chains and energy. And I'd love to hear your take on those things.
Yeah. So I think it's all intertwined. It's all connected. And that's really one of the big, that's why central planning fails. Just like modern medicine today, right? The body is a complex system. And so when you have a complex system, you can't just treat one piece without thinking about the consequences that will happen all over the body. So for example, you know, you go to the doctor and you say you have heartburn. And so he says, okay, take this, you know, heartburn pill, antacid, right? But then it has all kinds of side effects in other parts of your body when the reality is like, why don't you just change your diet, right? Or something like that. Yeah. And I think the market is the same way, right? In the United States, 330 million people, you know, almost 8 billion people globally that have these humans are irrational, right? We have this never ending change of wants, needs, and desires. I love vanilla ice cream. And today I just want chocolate. I don't know why. I just do. And that's just the way it works. And so how is it that that one part or that one product I need shows up on the shelf when I need it at the right time, at the right price? How, you know, one product, an iPhone could have, you know, 10,000 different parts in it made by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of different people. So how can they all coordinate to get all the parts together to get it manufactured? And it's through a free market and through the money supply. The money is the price. The price provides a signal that tells the market what to make more of, what to make less of, et cetera. And so when you dump in, you know, $8 trillion, $10 trillion in 24 months, the price signal goes haywire and people don't know what to do anymore. And so because of that, the entire organism, the entire market gets messed up. So for example, well, one, we go back to, they shut the economy off and then they tried to turn it back on again. Well, that doesn't work apparently. So they shut the economy off. They tried to turn it back on. And then what happened is then they dumped a bunch of money into the market. So then everybody goes and starts buying a bunch of goods and services. Well, typically what would happen is the prices would start going up. So then people would buy less of those goods and services, which would then ease some of the pain. And then because the price also went up, more people would make more goods and services and the market would eventually even out. But because they just keep dumping more fake money into the system, the price going up doesn't stop people. They just keep buying anyway. And they keep buying, they keep buying, they keep buying. But then the other problem is that the manufacturers can't produce more of it because the prices went up so high, they can't invest into new manufacturing, new warehouses, new shipping containers, any of that. So the price messed it up. So neither the demand comes down, nor does the supply come back up. So that's a big problem. But then we have, just leave it to central planning. They can mess it up even more. And this is where things start get really, really scary and interesting. Then of course, then they start shutting people down. So now we have less people working. Now there's mandates being put into place to prevent even more people from working, which causes even more shortages, which causes price to go up even higher. So then they dump even more money in, which, you know, makes it worse. And then we have, I made a video over a year ago, year and a half ago, 13, 14 months ago on YouTube. And it was titled Warning, What's Happening in California is Coming for the Rest of the World. And that video has like almost 1 million views on it. And I was talking about how California was having rolling blackouts,
right,
and how the rest of the country and the rest of the world was going to have the same problem. And the reason that I gave in that video wasn't because I had a crystal ball I consulted, but rather because it was policies that California put into place, which shut down natural gas, which shut down coal plants, which shut down two of their three nuclear reactors to switch it all to renewables, wind and solar. The problem was they didn't get the energy from wind and solar, but they shut down the plants anyway. Right. What do you think is going to happen? It's not rocket science. Well, the rest of the world did adopt all those same policies. As a matter of fact, Boris Johnson from the UK a few weeks ago at the big meeting said, "We want the UK to be the example for the world." I'm like, great. Well, that's a good example because the UK is in the worst situation. They're sitting on massive reserves of natural gas, but they can't get it out of the ground because, you know, the environment. They've shut down all their coal plants. They thought, just like California thought they could get electricity from their neighbors, Arizona, Nevada. But when California needed it, right, so did they. They didn't have any left over. The UK thought they could get energy from France. Well, France didn't have any to spare. And apparently all their windmills didn't work in September because it was a very low wind season. I mean, who would have guessed, right? So they're stuck without energy. So natural gas prices have gone up 800% in Europe. Well, when natural gas goes up, the electricity companies need the natural gas. So now their prices went up. So electricity went up by 400%. But now the electricity companies are going out of business. Over a dozen of them have gone out of business. But what else do we need natural gas for? I mean, on top of it just going being more expensive, they say lots of people might freeze to death this winter without being able to heat their homes. But even worse than that, the natural gas is used to make fertilizer. What do we need fertilizer for? Oh, to grow food. Mm-hmm. What else? Oh, we use it to make CO2. What do we need CO2 for? Oh, to process meat, to package food. Oh, that's a problem. And then it's not just in Europe. It's happening in California. It's happening in South America. It's even happening in China, India. India, 75% of their power comes from coal powered plants. They have 135 coal power plants. They typically have about a 30-day supply of coal on hand. And now they have days of coal supply on hand. Now, why? Well, because they can't get enough. That's a problem. China's trying to buy all the coal they can get. China can't get enough coal because their hydropower didn't get enough power this year because, we had a low rain year. Unreliable. So now here's where it gets interesting. So now China, remember, we already have supply chains breaking down. China now doesn't have enough energy. They're starting to ration their factories. You can only work a couple of days a week now. What does that do to supply chains? Now they're not producing enough goods. The cost of energy goes up to transport the goods. I mean, it's just a mess.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when I found Bitcoin, I kind of, you know, turned to this sort of, you can maybe call it a financial revolution. Maybe it's a technological revolution. Maybe it's both. But
it's both.
I had a lot of relief just from the very first, you know, a couple of Satoshis I was able to acquire. And it gave me freedom of mind. It taught me about sovereignty in the real world, because I couldn't just think about it, but I could do more things from a sovereign perspective. But right now, you know, there's just a lot going on with like borders closing and these energy crises you're talking about and money printing. Is there anywhere you can go? Is there anywhere in the world you can go and have it all anymore?
Man, that's a tough question. It's something I've thought a lot about and had a lot of conversations about. And I guess it just depends on what all is to you. But, you know, I get asked all the time because I spend a lot of time researching this stuff. Like, where are we going to go? And the answer is like where I think to answer your question, I don't think there's anywhere that you can go to have it all. And when I say that, I mean, I think, you know, that where people want to go means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'm a surfer. Like, I want to go somewhere there's a beach. Not everybody cares about that, right? So maybe you don't care about a beach. So I'm limited to certain places where I can be on the beach and there's good waves. That's not my highest priority. My highest priority is freedom, right? That's my highest priority. But I've talked to some people who are like, I'm ready just to move to Sweden and I'll just pay the 50%, 60, 70% tax. I don't even care. So they would rather pay the taxes, but have the medical freedom over there. Mm-hmm. Whereas I know other people would rather go somewhere and get rid of the taxes, like in Puerto Rico, for example. In Puerto Rico, you have no taxes, but you have a mandate in place, right? So what's all for you? And I think you have to figure out what's important to you, which areas kind of have those things, and then you need to go try to optimize as best as you can for those things.
Yeah, I hear you on that. It's a sort of triangulation there. You know,
yeah, and then you add to it the fact that we don't know what's going to happen, right? So, like, I think it was last week. A lot of people I know from Canada have been moving to Costa Rica, mm-hmm. and then I think it was last week. Costa Rica announced that now they have a mandate put into place, and all these people are like, well, now we just left Canada because of that. Now we're going to Costa Rica. What are we going to do now? And so, I think part of it is also being prepared to like be, unfortunately. Be ready to move if you need to. I mean, if that's important enough to you.
Yeah. In terms of these cycles, particularly maybe the political one, do you think we're sort of through the eye of the storm or through the needle? Or is this, you know, going to get a little worse in the short term?
I don't. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's going to get worse. I mean, let me just say, I don't want to be all doom and gloom. I believe that there's massive hope and prosperity on this side. I believe that my kids and grandkids will have a much better future. So let me just say that. But unfortunately, I think we're going to continue to get worse for the next several years. My kind of forecast that I'm looking at, a lot of people think I'm too optimistic on this. I would say probably over the next 2 to 5 years, we continue to probably slide downhill. Things probably continue to get worse. Someone asked me yesterday if a magic wand was waved and all the leadership changed and they just magically tried to get all the supply chains working again and stuff like that, how fast would it take to get things moving again? And even at that rate, it would take years. It would take years. I talked to some people in the Midwest. I talked to a couple different people over the last few days. And they were telling me that that they've had to start locking up their tractors in barns now because people are coming by and stealing parts off of them because they can't get any parts. They can't even get tires. You can't even get a tractor tire right now. So if a tractor loses a tire, it can't even get a new tire. They're saying that best case scenario, if you order parts for your farm equipment today, best case scenario, you're looking at spring of 2023. And if that shows up a little bit late, you miss your spring plant, then you have no harvest at the end of 23. You're looking at 2024. That's 3 years out. Like, you don't just magically wave a wand and this doesn't just go away. Like, that's a just right there alone. Our farm is at risk for the next 3 to 4 years. Wow. That's just that. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, remember, things get so bad, they switch. And I think just like, an alcoholic or a drug dealer, you kind of have to hit rock bottom before you're ready to switch. And so I think for the next couple of years, they're going to continue to get worse. I think we'll continue to see more governments, what what always happens, going back through history, is governments will always continue to try to squeeze harder and harder and harder. They're trying to hang on as best as they can. Like China, they're imposing capital control laws, trying to keep the capital in the state, right? They're trying to do everything they can to hang on. But the more they do that, the more it causes people to push back. And so I think they're going to continue to squeeze harder and harder and harder for the next couple of years. People will continue to squeeze, push back harder and harder and harder. We're going to continue to see, unfortunately, and again, this brings me no hope to say that or joy to say this, but we may not have food for 3 years. I mean, that's what the people on the farms are telling me right now. Like, if they can't get parts for 3 years, what does that do? I mean, in the UK, they don't have natural gas to get fertilizer and they don't have fertilizer to grow crops. Like, unless they do something to solve that, like, that problem doesn't get fixed right away. So I think 2 to 5 years is probably, unfortunately, where I think we get worse. I think then we switch. I think the pendulum really starts to swing and things start improving. What I say, people think I'm too optimistic on this. I think by the end of the decade, I think things are looking really good. I think we see the end of the giant nation state. I think we start to see much smaller government, more decentralized governments, similar to what the United States was founded on. I think I keep this book on my desk, which I reference all the time, which I think is very telling for, I think, where the future goes. So I think 2 to 5 years, yeah, sovereign individual. I think 2 to 5 years, it probably continues to get worse. I think after 5 years, we start swinging back the other way. By the end of the decade, I think we're looking pretty good. Yeah. So when Klaus Schwab and the WF says that by 2030, you'll own nothing and be happy, I think they're wrong.
Yeah, but they do have a plan.
They do have a plan.
Yeah.
And I have a plan to beat him, and everybody else needs to have a plan to beat him too.
In terms of that and planning or any kind of context along those lines, you know, without getting lost in the word and whether I'm not trying to talk about physical war or Vietnam, but are we in some kind of metaphysical or psychological or information war or even some sort of metaphysical war between the nation state and the individual?
Well, we're certainly at war. 100% we're at war. I think people just need to kind of think about a different definition of what war is. I think, and again, maybe I'm too optimistic, but I think the wars of the future or even of the current, but of the future are really fought over information and money. I don't, you know, not shooting anymore. I think it's all over information and money. And I think World War III is really, it's the globalists against the people. That's what we're seeing right now. You know, all the governments are basically in cahoots together and all the people are kind of pushing back against that. And so I would say that we are at war. I think it's pretty evident. I mean, just look in the United States alone, we can see that the leaders, the Biden administration, the news media, et cetera, they're constantly telling you what you see, what you hear isn't true. It's a war of information. The famous one is Let's Go Brandon, right? Like everyone's saying, Let's Go Brandon, Let's Go Brandon, Let's Go Brandon. Where that came from was everybody was chanting F Joe Biden at the NASCAR race. And the reporter said, oh, they're saying, Let's Go Brandon. Like everyone could hear what they were saying, but it's like this war of information. No, you didn't hear that. That's not what you heard. Oh, you know, today, was it today or yesterday? The White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, said they were asking her, hey, you know, shortages are happening. It's really bad. Like what's the White House going to do about it? And she said, oh yeah, your treadmill. That's what she said. Oh yeah, your treadmill. I think people can wait a little bit of time for the treadmill. Meanwhile, in Denver, they're reporting that they have no milk because they can't get cartons for the kids. So the schools have no food because they can't get supply. So like we have a literal problem where kids in schools aren't getting food. And she's joking about treadmills. Like, and so I think there's this real war on education, or I'm sorry, on information. Of course, you know, Joe Rogan had Sanjay Gupta on the other day, and we'll be careful on your channel. But you know, he kind of dug into him and he said, "Look, CNN lied. They lied. Yeah, and are they? What are you going to say about it?" And then, of course, when Sanjay went back on CNN, they just kind of joked about it. And so there's a real war of information going on. And then of course, money wise, there's a war. We talked about the IRS trying to, you know, come after bank accounts with $600. I think they're raising it to 10,000 now. They're talking about, you know, raising. So we're definitely being waged war on information for sure, money as well. And then of course, you know, overreach and oppressors of governments.
Yeah. Incredible. I saw that interview on Rogan, or at least that part of it, really wild stuff. And there's a lot of defensive posturing there, but do you think this is the kind of war that's going to take guns for the people to be successful?
Well, like I said, you know, I think, and again, maybe it's the optimist in me, but I think the war of the future is just fought over information and money. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that it's not fought over guns. I could see it going to that. I hope it doesn't. You know, the problem, if you go back again, looking through history, what happens when you have these, if you go back and look at, you know, in Russia, when you had Lenin and Stalin in power, or you had Mao is a really good example. Hitler is a good example. But they get the people to turn on each other. And the people turning on each other is more powerful than the army, because the army is very small. The army is a couple percent, right? So you have 3% of the population rise up against the army. The army is worthless. You need to get the people to turn on each other. And when Mao had the Cultural Revolution going, they had the Red Army. And the Red Army were so vicious. It was civilians killing other civilians. They were so vicious that even Mao was shocked. Even he was a little bit scared, but he didn't do anything to stop it. And so I think we can kind of see the same thing happening right now where, and this is just unfortunate, you know, just 2 years ago, people with differing viewpoints could still be civil to each other. Right. But today, unfortunately, most people aren't. I think the reason why, in my opinion, is that on one side, you have live and let live. Hey, look, I'll do me. Mm-hmm. You do you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You'd make your choice. I make my choice. We can still be friends. We're just going to make different choices. Good luck. But today we have a problem where one side isn't cool with that. They want to say, no, you have to choose what I choose, or you're wrong. And so that's where the problem is. And that's where that cultural problem really comes into place. And so I think one side has like tolerance, like, hey, let me do me, you do you. The other side is like, nope, if you don't do this, then you're dangerous, you're unclean, you need to be locked up, you need to be quarantined, you need to be whatever. And so it could go to that shooting war. I sure hope not.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy stuff. It's definitely, very, I never wanted to live in interesting times. I was happy if my career would be exciting. I could just go home and life would just be very calm and peaceful, and just every day is, you know, what I want it to be with my wife and kids. But
yeah,
you know, turning, you know, to your live event that you are putting on in Miami, November 12th to 14th, you know, I think these events are important and powerful. They're bringing together like-minded individuals. There's, you know, great speakers and ideas presented. And so I'd love to hear from you some of the speakers, you know, that you've invited to speak there. And yeah, why you, I'd really like to hear why you chose these speakers, you know, and I think that would really frame up, I think, you know, maybe how you see a little bit about what's going on in the world, but I'd love to hear why you picked your speakers.
Yeah. So, so the event I'm having is specifically, to try to help people navigate what I think is going to happen over the next couple of years. So I've kind of laid out my thesis, why I think it's happening. I've kind of laid out my time frame. As I said, I do believe there's massive hope and prosperity on the other side. And again, I've been studying these wealth transfers for over a dozen years. And so what I've learned is that if you learn to position yourself right, the money flows to you, come out way ahead. So, if you're not paying attention, you choose to ignore this, it's probably going to be really, really bad for you. But if you're paying attention, if you're prepared, it could be some of the best. I mean, it's not going to be fun, but on the other side of it, you could end up in a way better position. And that's what I want to happen for myself. That's what I want to happen for everybody else. And so I put together an event just for that. Learn how to build, grow, and protect your wealth and your freedom in today's out of control world. That's kind of the headline. So not just build, grow, and protect your wealth, but also your freedom. And so I chose speakers that I thought would be able to talk about that specifically. I have like 15 speakers coming who I wanted them to basically tell you, here's what I think is going to happen over the next couple of years. And here's what you should be doing to protect yourself and kind of answer those two questions. And so it's not just a Bitcoin conference, or it's not even just a financial conference. It's about how to survive, how to thrive through the next couple of years. And so I wanted speakers that could hit on a bunch of different topics, all the way from kind of the big picture, what's happening from the macro picture, from political and financial, all the way through how do I build my wealth? How do I grow my wealth? How to protect my wealth? And then into my health, how do I protect my health? And then into even my sovereignty, onshore solutions, offshore passport solutions, and things like that. So I basically have somebody that kind of hits every single piece of the spectrum that I think you need to survive. And so that's kind of what I did. So some of the speakers, I have a Gerald Celente. He's a legend. 40 years, he's run the Trends Journal. He's been calling out the trends. He's nailed so many big ones over the years. He's a legend. So he's going to kind of come give that big picture. I got one of my good buddies, George Gammon, coming. He's a really good macro guy. I got Greg Foss. He's a legend in the Bitcoin space, talking about the bond market, the credit markets, what's going to happen. I got Brent Johnson from the Dollar Milkshake Theory talking about the currencies and what he thinks is going to happen. So that's kind of setting up the financial system and the trends and what we're looking at. Then I got Pomp's coming to talk about what he sees happening in the business world, investing. I got Breedlove coming to talk about, you know, what is money and sovereignty, things like that. I have Untapped Growth, Joel coming to talk about, onshore living, like sustainable living, things like that. Katie, the Russian, coming to talk about, multi-flag theory, jurisdictional arbitrage, etc. I got the big name is I got Dr. Joe Mercola coming. Dr. Joe Mercola is a legend, 25 years in natural medicine. He became the number one target for censorship because of the whole medical situation that's going on. He still has over 1 million people that follow him offline. So he's going to talk about how to build and protect your wealth. I'm sorry, your health, and censorship. I got Stefan Lavera coming to talk about, he's living a life on a run. He had to kind of escape his country. So he's going to talk about having to escape his country, how he's lived on the run. I got my friend Yahya Bakar coming to talk about how to protect your assets, how to keep them out of the view and protect them. So by 2030, you still end up owning a bunch of things. Mm-hmm. So that kind of sums it up. That kind of rounds it out. And so, all the way from what's happening all the way down to protecting your assets and everything in between.
That sounds awesome. All of them are great. Yeah, I'm super excited, very much to hear from Stefan about his personal story more. It's really just so relevant. It's great to hear him as a Bitcoiner, but just what he's gone through and he gets to shed more light on that. I think that's really is riveting. My final question to you is how has Bitcoin changed you in any way? It seemed like you were very primed for Bitcoin. It seemed like you were very sort of primed for a lot of these things and seeking them out. So has there been any sort of notable ways where it might have changed you?
A lot of ways, ton of ways. I would say it's funny that you said that. I think it's kind of the second time you brought that up. I've kind of grown, I look back on my life, as I said, I've kind of reverse engineered this. And like, I almost feel like I was made for this because I have to understand Bitcoin, you really have to know multiple disciplines. I mean, maybe 8 different disciplines, right? From history and economics and money, philosophy, technology, all these things. And like, I've kind of been this like master of, or jack of all trades, master of none. I have like this really wide set of knowledge and I feel like I am kind of made for this. But how has it changed me? I think a couple of things. One, I would say it's made me way more hopeful and optimistic. So as I said, like 2012, I was kind of like disillusioned with the whole system. I was like, I'm not going to be a freedom fighter. I'll be living on a beach in Nicaragua, fishing and surfing. Like I'm out. Like, so I was very disillusioned. So now it's given me hope. So that's a big one. I know they say, our good buddy Svetsky says, Bitcoin is hope. So that's a big one. I think, it's changed my time preference. We talk about that all the time. So, I don't want to spend any of my Bitcoin. Like I won't spend it. And so I've become just much more conscientious on spending money. That's worked out really, really well for me. And the more that it grows and the bigger it gets, the more I don't want to spend it even more. So it's changed my total time preference on that. So I think those are two big ways. And of course, when you change your time preference, it affects every area of your life. All good things come from building over time. So your health takes time, your relationships take time, your business takes time. And so when you change that, it changes everything. Also, I would say is that it's given me a whole new community. And I said kind of at the beginning that your network is your net worth. Mm-hmm. And it's connected me with some really good people, some really good friends, and having, connections. I mean, like you and I would have never met if it wasn't for Bitcoin. Right. And so it's done that. So I would say those are probably the three biggest ways, which are massive, obviously. The hope probably being the big one.
Yeah, that's wild. Great stuff, man. I really appreciate our conversation, our time together. I do think, like, you know, I look at a lot of your trajectory, and I do think, you know, in the light of being like primed for this, or, you know, ready for this your whole life, I think you've carved a path that is very, I don't think enviable is the right word, but just sort of like an example would be a better word, and something to follow. And, you know, it's been great. I really enjoy this. Just definitely before we roll out, let people know where they could find you and how they can get tickets to see Market Disruptors live in Miami on the 12th of November.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to hear any more of this type of content, I put out a ton of content. I have a YouTube channel. I put out 3 videos a week. I have a radio show. I have a podcast. I'm super active on Twitter, One Mark Moss on Twitter. The best place, if you want to find all that, is just go to my website, onemarkmoss.com. It's the number one, onemarkmoss.com. You can find everything there, including the event. The event is marketdisruptorslive.com. So go to marketdisruptorslive.com. or just onemarkmoss.com, and you'll find all that stuff linked.
Yeah, man. This has been so dope. Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was super fun.
This episode with Mark Moss on 3 revolutionary cycles happening at once, how that affects the political, economic, social, and cultural spheres, and how you can prepare was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 Conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about and get 50 free USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Last year, over 10,000 Bitcoiners came to celebrate Bitcoin at Bitcoin 2021. And for Bitcoin 2022, organizers are expecting tens of thousands of crazy-ass Bitcoiners. It's going to be off the hook, and I hope to see you there and chill out with a cold beer. For 10% off, make sure to use our code BitcoinMatrix at checkout. You can follow the show on Twitter at DeLaBTCMatrix, and you can follow me on Twitter at SedYungleman. Both accounts have Bitcoin tips turned on. I know how precious those sats are, so thanks to those of you who have already hit me up with some Bitcoin. I've decided to go full time on the show and pursue a career in Bitcoin, so your support means a lot. If you are a Bitcoin company and interested in reaching a large, discerning audience of Bitcoiners, hit me up in my Twitter DMs or email me at CedricYungleman@gmail.com. And thank you for listening. Stack stats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.